Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jeff St. John. Jeff spells his last name capital S T period J O H N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Jeff. How are you today?
Very good, Tom. Hope you are as well.
Yes, thank you. Happy New Year. Jeff, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. We left off last time talking about bolts and how to use them in bridge construction and the ways to tighten them up and all that sort of stuff. We'd also talked about getting the tiebacks in for the Flagstaff side of the bridge and starting to put some steel down. Land me back in that story and take me forward, if you would.
Well, of course. Yeah, so in general, you can look at this project as being almost distinctly divided into thirds. The first third of the project was the excavation work and the foundation work, primarily on the Flagstaff side of the canyon on the Navajo reservation side to get ready for the steel erection. So that took 8 or 9 months, and then it was time to start the steel erection, and that in turn took about another 8 or 9 months, the middle third of the project, and then the final third of the job was the decking of the bridge and final paving and all the items that have to happen in order to put traffic on the structure.
Okay.
So we had just finished that first third when the steel erection started. I want to say that was in March of 94. And the steel erector, Trailer Brothers, they arrived on site and they started erecting the steel from the Flagstaff side in order to go out the cantilever out over the canyon, approximately 350 feet, I think. And so that was the start of that effort.
Okay.
The operation, that's when they brought in some specialty cranes. They brought in a specialty crane that would actually ride out along the structure, along the top of it as they constructed it, and handle the individual steel members of the truss and erect those. So we were literally just getting started there in March of 94.
That crane sat on a pretty big platform. And typical cranes, like truck cranes, I think that was a modified truck crane, if I have it right. They might have outriggers, and so my concept is that platform that the crane sat on acted as an outrigger structure for the crane. Does that make sense?
In a way, certainly. What dictated the size of the frame? The frame's purpose was to distribute the loads from the crane itself into the appropriate members of steel.
Okay.
And in order to, the appropriate members in this case were effectively directly above what we would call the top cords of the truss.
Okay.
And the frame had to be a certain width in order to direct the force into those members.
Got it.
It probably could have been narrower if the bridge had been narrower, but it had to be a certain width just to do that force distribution correctly.
Okay.
And that's what outriggers do as well. Outriggers are distributing the force from a crane to certain locations to improve the capacity of the crane.
So right.
Very similar purpose.
Right. Okay. So the first pieces of steel would have been down on the SKEWBACK, SKEWBACK foundations going up and then out? I think maybe we talked about this already.
Well, we, No, we didn't. But okay. Yeah. So there were one or two spans that were not over the canyon. They short spans of structural steel that basically if you drew a vertical line from that skew back from the arch foundation there and went in this case east towards Flagstaff.
Yep.
There was, I'm guessing now, but roughly 100 feet of bridge structure back there that had to be erected.
Okay.
And then the tall, probably the biggest members on the bridge, at least size-wise, were the vertical pieces that came up from the arch foundation to just below the deck level above the skew vents. So those had to be put in place. Get that frame built behind the arch, if you will, so that they could start the construction that would cantilever out over the canyon.
And so those vertical pieces, the first panel or two, the first span or two, however you want to word it, those would have then been connected to the tiebacks to hold this whole cantilever half of a bridge from tipping down into the canyon.
Absolutely, yes. There was a special temporary connection built between the permanent structural steel that's still out there and this temporary tieback foundation that we installed.
Okay.
It's a temporary steel connection that was specially fabricated and installed to function as a stability tieback.
And those were drilled and grouted, sort of expansion bolt kind of things. How was that done? How was that tieback anchored to the ground?
Post tensioning, it's a system of anchoring it into the rock, into a drilled hole. It's a high strength steel that is installed. It's actually cables. In bundles that are put in, and then when the grout is installed and cures to bond it to the rock, then we actually apply force to those cables to anchor the foundation back into the rock where it won't come. So.
Okay. And then there was some sort of an arrangement that was put in place, and I was wondering if you could explain it to me, that once the cantilever was out from both sides of the river, this arrangement would allow the entire cantilevered half bridge to go up and down and upstream and downstream, so sort of right and left.
A little bit, yeah. There was not much right-left.
Like 6 inches or a foot? What? How much?
I would definitely measure it in inches, and it's probably not even 6.
Okay.
This is much more, the purpose of the system was much more the up and down that you mentioned.
Okay.
There was a special jacking mechanism built into that tieback frame that could allow adjustments up and down on occasion, and it didn't need much adjustment. I only recall it happening 2 or 3 times total where it was utilized. And perhaps it was more, but I just didn't see that many operations. The target geometry was well engineered and defined. And,
okay, yep.
Because of that, not a lot of adjustment was required. Certainly some was.
Okay.
But of course, the farther you went out over the canyon, the harder, the more weight was on everything, and the harder that would be to do. So they tried to set the geometry as early as they could when there wasn't a lot of weight on the structure. And more than hope, because it was engineered. It was, there
yes.
was a lot of thought put into it.
Right.
But hope that you ended up relatively close to the right place when you got out.
Right. How did even just moving up and down a foot, let's say,
which we did not, I don't recall us ever having to adjust that much.
Okay.
We're talking inches, if not fractions of inches. We're not talking point or form.
All right. That's pretty impressive to get out there 350 feet both sides and only be a few inches that it needed to be tweaked just a bit. And we're talking about steel expanding and contracting that much.
Steel will expand and contract, certainly. But some of that's anticipated. Some of that, on a daily basis, is not going to expand and contract feet. Again, it might be fractions of an inch or even an inch or two, but it's not a huge amount of movement on a day-to-day basis.
Okay.
And then there were daily surveys that went on to monitor it.
Oh, okay.
And to make sure that things were heading in the right place.
Nice. How did that actual system work to align to move the entire structure up and down, even just fraction of an inch? How did that work? Do you remember
the hydraulic system that was built into the Tyvek?
Okay.
I can't really explain it. If I see a picture, I'm sure it'd be very obvious that there was a mechanism, a location that was designed in the Tyvek frame where jacks could be installed or and to use to either lower it or raise it.
Okay.
And by lowering or raising, they were either lengthening or shortening the Tyvek steel.
Oh.
That's what actually raised.
Okay.
And then when they would get it to the desired location, the desired arrangement, then there were mechanisms in place to secure it so that you weren't sitting there on a hydraulic jack that may or may not stay inflated properly for a long period of time. So they would what we would call dog it off, make it a rigid connection that would not move on its own until it was time to make an adjustment at a future point in time.
That makes perfect sense. Okay. So then it's time to start erecting the steel out over the river, Flagstaff side first. What do you recall about that?
Oh, I think that was what I would call the learning process. For the crews to learn the work, for all of us that were watching the crews do it, with our learning process of how to plan for the day-to-day and week-to-week and month-to-month activities, and to work with the designer, Rob Turton, to make sure that it was going out correctly. There was also a construction engineer for Trailer Brothers, Jim Neal. He was also intensely involved through that process to make sure that it everything was going correctly with the steel erection. So the first part of the project is very common. It's what we call the learning curve. It's where everybody's seeing how things behave, making adjustments as necessary to the work procedures or even the workers themselves to try to optimize everything and achieve the goals. So that I remember, that there was a lot of that that everybody learned. And then later on, of course, when they were able to take what they had learned and go to the other side of the river and work from that way, and because the lessons had already been learned, it was much more efficient, much faster.
Okay. So to get into that learning curve a little bit. I'm assuming, again, first panel, second panel, and then out over the river. Does it start from the bottom and work its way up? Or the bottom cord, does that go on first and then get built up above that?
So the bottom cords of the arch would be for every unit. Directing out that the proper process would be install the bottom cords of the arches,
okay.
The two sides, and get those in position. And then when those were in position, then they install the diagonal. diagonal element that comes basically to the top of the deck level of the structure down to the leading edge of the arch rib, it's a diagonal element. Now, that basically is going to hold that unit there.
Okay.
And then erect the vertical pieces, and then the upper pieces that the top cords, we would call them, and then the deck floor beams themselves, the pieces that are going to eventually support the bridge deck.
Got it. So
very, very, very systematic process, and of course, because of the nature of the arch, the most complicated part is where you start, right there from the arch foundation. Those first pieces have they're much longer. The vertical members, the diagonal members, the number of pieces of bracing required, that the arch is deepest at that location. By the time they get out to the center, the arch, the whole structure is dramatically less tall, and so there's fewer members and fewer locations, so things can go a lot faster as you keep going out further.
Got it. So not only do the workers get comfortable with how things are fitting together, but there's less things to fit together.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it.
Okay. What do you remember about those first units going together, and what were your thoughts at the time?
Well, it's been so long now. I thought it went well. I thought in general that folks were learning fast and learning the proper procedures and how to get things going correctly. Now I look on it from a different perspective that I had back then. That was one of my first steel projects there. But it's actually the second. But to see the guys and how they were doing the individual operations and help point out some places where maybe they needed improvement or giving some attaboys for things they were doing well.
Okay.
And spending a lot of time, because it's a schedule-driven project, and in order to schedule deliveries at the right rate for the steel, and then later on for the work that was going to occur after the steel was erected, a large part of my effort would have been focused on making sure the guys had what they needed to work next week, the month after that, and 6 months after that.
Okay.
And of course, that all depends upon how they're doing on a day-to-day process, procedure system.
So that would be not only the structural steel for the bridge members, but the bolts and, just all the hardware to put everything together.
And from the bridge side. From the truss side, and of course I had to worry about what was going to occur after the steel was erected and make sure those things were in place, those materials were set up.
So, as far as concrete decking across the top of the bridge and railing
and then all the things that needed to be in place to do the paving and final grading.
Oh, okay.
Utility work and all those kind of things.
All right. Did you actually get out on the half bridge when it was under construction? Would you, go out there once a day or every couple of days and just hang out, watch the guys work and see how things were going on?
Yeah, I certainly not every day. I would probably say I went out there 2 or 3 times a week just to see how things, out to what we call the leading edge.
Okay.
Daily, I would, of course, go out and watch what the progress was from not the leading edge to back on the land. I'd go out from time to time and see how things were going. It is a very repetitious process. Once the guys know what they're doing, there usually are very, very few surprises.
Okay.
As they've learned that, okay, this is the way I need to set this piece, the way I need to pin it, bolt it, and all the things that need to be done before I move on to the next step, it's all extremely.
Would you watch that operation from the old bridge, or would you find a rock somewhere and hang out on the cliff edge, or how would you do that?
Mostly from the back behind where the bridge is being built. The existing bridge was still open to traffic at that time.
Okay.
On that narrow deck was not to be advised.
Not advised. All right. Okay. And then when you actually got it out to the last unit out there, do you have any thoughts about that? Was it like, oh, that's good, that's easy, all right, moving on?
Well, there was a lot of, I think there was a lot, on the first half, there wasn't a lot of thoughts about that. It got out there, great, woo-hoo, let's go to the other side and do it again. It was interesting to see, and I've got a few pictures, you see half a bridge, how it's hanging over the canyon, not something you normally see, so it's visually impressive. Completing the first half, there wasn't a lot of pomp and circumstance involved with that. It was, okay, we got that. Now, are we ready to go over to the other side? Did my crews have all the foundation work ready for them? And are ready to just move right over and start building it from the other side? Everybody did their work properly, and it did happen like that. We moved right over and built the other half. Of course, that one, as it trended towards completing, that was a much bigger deal to see how things were going to line up and what efforts were going to be needed to what we call close the bridge. That was a lot.
Okay. Can you tell me what you remember about moving from the Flagstaff side to the Marble Canyon Lodge side? What did you have to take down? What did you have to put together on the other side?
We had already been over there with my crews building the foundation. So we had in the Ames crews for us doing the excavation.
Okay.
Yeah. So we moved that equipment over that was necessary to do the excavation. And early, this would have been about the same time the steel erection started. We went ahead and moved the other equipment over there to do the excavation and do the foundations. That transfer of work and materials and equipment had already occurred.
Okay.
So then to move the steel erection over to the inside, well, that was a relatively small crane on that traveling platform. So that broke down very fast in order to haul it over to the other side. There was an assist crane, I believe, that we moved over there as well, that the crane that would unload the structural steel delivery that they arrived by the truck. If it was a different crane that would unload those. Moving
okay.
Those over. But it's not because we had the existing bridge right there, it's a relatively fast one.
Yeah.
Where we see some of these jobs we go to where we're working on two sides of a major river and there's no other existing bridge close by to get from one side and go back around to the other. Can be a dramatic exercise in mobilization and remobilization. In this case, we didn't. So,
was there anything so heavy that you actually had to drive it around and couldn't take it across the historic bridge?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, the existing bridge had a decent weight capacity as long as there were no other loads on the bridge at that minute. Right.
Okay.
So if a heavier than normal load would need to go across, we would have flaggers there to stop traffic from.
Oh, you would. Okay.
To stop all other traffic from using the bridge while things did. The things we took over there weren't that big, so not anything special.
Okay. All right. And then
I think the hardest thing moving from side to side was the width of the old bridge, right? It was so narrow that we certainly had to stop traffic because there wasn't another car to pass.
Got
it. We were going across.
Okay.
And even though there were very nice signs, when I arrived there in there were always signs that wait for oncoming traffic to come across, and mostly talking to semi-truck drivers and RV drivers. And some of them would not read the sign very well, and they would try to cross at the same time in flat mirrors. There was plenty of broken mirror glass all across it.
Yeah, the battle of the rear view mirrors when they whack into each other, when you scrape past one another.
Yeah, and then they would overcorrect and they would knock their other mirror off on the railing of the existing bridge. So, yeah.
Boy, yeah, I can remember going across that to put river trips together, and it was always an eye-opening moment. And,
yep.
You know, just you hope nobody was coming the other way.
Yeah. And it was, of course, and the field of view was more limited when we got there than because with the excavation we did, we made the field of view a little bit better where you can see oncoming traffic
right.
Earlier. But I do remember when we first were starting, you were just driving through the desert, driving through the desert, driving through the desert. Oh, my goodness, I'm 500 feet above the river.
Yeah, there was a curve there, and you sort of make this curve, and you were on the bridge. And it's not like coming in from the Flagstaff side. You had a lot of take your time and look around because you can see who's coming. That didn't work that way.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so everything got moved over to the Marble Canyon Lodge side and headed out. I've just got to ask you, was there a time when maybe that Marble Canyon side was maybe halfway built, you kind of looking at things going, is this going to line up? Or was it like, yeah, it all looks really good all the way?
Well, I come from a surveying background, so I spent a lot of time talking to the surveyor for Trailer Brothers. It was always doing well, so I wasn't
nice. Do you remember who that surveyor was?
No, I don't remember his name.
Okay. All right. Anything else you remember about that second half build that was unusual or that you remember was interesting or funny or not so funny?
Well, as it came time, I wouldn't say we closed the bridge in November, where the two sides connected together. That was interesting. We got out there to the time to set the arch ribs to connect into each other, and you know, it was an afternoon, and it was a typical warm, but not hot, just warm, sunny afternoon out there, and I was out there on the edge with Ed Kent and some of his guys. We measured the whole space that was between the two different cantilevers that the pins had to go into to secure it in place to make it a one-piece bridge instead of two individual pieces.
Okay.
And these pins were going off of memory now, but were roughly 12 inches in diameter and solid steel, so they had to fit in there, and then they would hold it and until the later on they were replaced by permanent folded steel plates. But early on, until the deck weight was on there, what that bridge still had to have some ability to move, so these pins allowed that movement.
Okay.
And we measured, and there wasn't quite enough room for the pin to fit in. We were like an inch too close.
Wow.
We had too little gap. And we started thinking, we had, because of the interest, because of the political interest and a lot of engineering interest, for months we had been getting questions about, okay, what day are you going to close the bridge? What day are you going to close the bridge?
Huh.
We're going to have a ceremony. We're going to give speeches. We're going to invite all kinds of VIPs. So we had to give them a date. We gave them a date. And this was the afternoon before that. Too close. Do we go back to those tiebacks, those adjustable tiebacks, and do we make the adjustment now, or do we do it tomorrow morning? Because we knew that process could take some hours to
do. Ah, okay.
A fast procedure. Kent, who was, you know, very wise judgment, he said, I don't want to move anything right now. Let's come back tomorrow morning early and see what might have happened. Thinking about sun effects and the temperature in the morning being cooler than the evening, and maybe the steel would shrink up a bit. And sure enough, we come in the next morning, and it's a drizzly gray morning.
Ooh.
And temperatures were probably in the 40s, something like that, versus the 70s and sunny the afternoon before.
Okay.
And we measured it. We're like, darn near perfect. the pin slid in like a hot knife into butter, and we were done. By 10 a.m., we were done. So we got to have the ceremony and quite the afternoon celebration and evening celebration, and all the VIPs were so happy they got to be there and, you know, see it. We kind of had to make it look like we were doing more than we did.
So the pin is a 12-inch diameter, and was it like only a foot or two long? How long is this thing?
I'm looking here at a picture now. It's probably about 2 feet long.
Okay, and there's one on one on either side.
Yeah, one on either side, one for each of the two cords.
For the bottom cords.
Yep.
Okay. And David.
There eventually, were some for the top cords too, but we weren't doing those that day. The main effort was to do the bottom.
Okay. Both Andy McElroy, the crane operator, and Dave Mesh, the erection foreman, mentioned that Andy was kind of funny. They asked him to take his headache ball that's got a big hook on the bottom and it's out on his jib for his crane. They lowered it down, and then they saw it swinging out and coming in and swinging out and coming in. And I guess David...
I remember Dave Mesh doing that. Yeah, that was him that did that.
And it worked. I mean, it's just like, hey, you know, if I'm trying to knock something in place and it's not going, I just go get a bigger hammer.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. A nice hammer on a pendulum there that they were able to use.
And I thought, what a great idea.
It did not need a lot of force, though. If it had been bound up, that would not have worked.
Right, exactly.
The fact that everything was in very good alignment, that gave them just the right amount of effort.
Which I just found, I say, hey, I need a big hammer. I got this giant pin here. I'm not going to be able to, like, you know, take my 22-ounce framing hammer and tap the thing in there. I need something a little bigger, and there it is right there. It was just perfect.
Now that I look at these holes in the steel in this picture, it's probably closer to, say, 15-inch diameter than 12-inch.
Okay. And then that pin, once it was in place, did the connecting plates that actually made the two halves into one solid unit, did they just go right over that pin so that pin is still in there, or was the pin taken out once the plates were plated up?
The pins are still in.
Okay.
But we could not do those connection plates for several months. The weight of the bridge decks had to be in place before you could do that.
Oh.
Yeah. So we, after we did the bridge deck, a handful of guys from Trailer Brothers came back out, and I want to say it would have been late spring, early summer of 1995, and they finished doing the bolt up of those plates at that point in time.
Okay. I was not aware of that. Okay.
Yeah, it's because the steel deflects quite a bit. There's a lot of concrete.
That's going to say,
yeah,
that's a huge amount of weight in and of itself.
Right.
And okay.
That whole structure deflected down due to the weight of the deck, and then that helped get the alignment correct for the bolts.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense as you're talking about it. Yeah. So with the two cantilevers now resting against each other, basically against this center pin, then you could finish off the top chord. And Gary Ladd has a nice photo of a little ceremony there that ironworkers have, which is when you top out, and there's Navajo Nation flag was there, the American flag was there. A couple pictures for that.
Yeah, that's usually very common to have a celebration when what I would call the last piece of structural steel goes in place.
Okay. And that's not a bigwig kind of deal. I mean, I'm assuming that...
No, that's more for the guys that built it.
Cool. What do you remember about that?
I honestly don't.
Okay.
Remember it. You know, again, for most of us, it was the actual connection of the arches that mattered the most.
Okay.
After that was... Sure, I mean, as you think about it, the guys, as soon as they're done connecting the steel or setting the last piece of steel, many of them, that was their last day on the job.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So the rest of them were out of there within a couple of weeks as the last thing they did was take the netting down that they had put up. And once the netting was down, Trailer Brothers was done, at least until we had them come back and do that final connection. About 6 months later.
Okay, all right. And then, so now the bridge is there. Then to build the concrete, you'd mentioned, I think, that there was a batch plant that was made there on the Navajo side, so that
on the Marble Canyon.
Oh, batch plant was on the Marble Canyon side. Thank you.
Yeah, right.
And then, it was pretty easy to make the concrete you needed and then roll it out in a truck. Or did you convey it out? How'd you get it out there?
So we had trucks deliver it to a conveyor system, and then the conveyors would haul it out. But first we had to put down all the decking, the sheet metal, if you will, that holds up the concrete.
Okay.
Put all that in place, and we had put all the reinforcing steel in place. So the concrete had to be poured in a particular sequence there because of the amount of bridge deflection that would occur. So quite common that you actually pour the concrete from the center back more than you do from the land out.
Why is that?
So that the deflection comes out, because otherwise, if you've done it the wrong way and the concrete is hard as you go out, more deflection occurs, it starts cracking the concrete already in place.
Oh.
Yeah, so I don't recall the exact pour sequence we used, but there was a very, very detailed pour sequence the designer had anticipated using, and so we followed that. But like I say, first things first is you had to put all the sheet metal forms in place. That took several months, and then we had to put the reinforcing steel in place. And after the reinforcing steel was in place, then it was time for the concrete. And that was, as you said, batched nearby and delivered to a conveyor belt system that conveyed the concrete out to the location that we were pouring that particular day.
Okay.
Typically, I can't even remember how many pours we had, but I'm going to say we had 10 to 12 deck pours that had to occur.
Okay. So you were pouring, what, 40 feet at a time?
Structures, when you count the approaches, is probably closer to 1,000 feet long, so we were probably doing 100 feet or so at a time.
Wow, okay, that's a lot of concrete to have to deal with at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. So when the concrete deck is done, then you have to bring the approaches to the concrete to finish that off.
Right, the paving. Well, there was some final embankment that went down. Most everything was done. Most of the excavation was done. The rough grading for the roadway was done. there's always a fine grading material that goes on top of that, and then the tape that goes in place. So they, the Ames, our subcontractor, started doing that work, working towards the bridge from each side of the river. But there was, I want to say on the Navajo side, almost a mile of it on the Marble Canyon side, there was at least half a mile of paving that had to go in place to tie it in.
Okay.
And so those efforts started while we were still doing the bridge deck. They came in and started putting the fine grading down for the roadway, and then they started doing some of the asphalt paving. So yeah, I mean, we started bridge decking in November of 94. We probably finished doing the bridge deck in May or June of 95. And then the paving had started also during that time period, and they finished up and actually tied it into the bridge there by late summer of 95.
Okay, let's go back to June. When that deck was done, when the concrete was done, and you had this conveyor belt going out there, and you would retreat the sections of the conveyor belt as the concrete worked its way back toward the land. At one point, somebody would have said, get in the car and drive across the bridge.
I think that somebody was probably me.
When did you have any idea what day you did that?
No, I don't. Not anymore. But yeah, as soon as we had the deck cleared off enough that I could drive them in there.
Wow. Congrats. Was that like your company pickup?
Yeah.
And were you a little nervous? Let's see how this works.
Oh, no. By then, I've already been on that. You know, during the tech paving operations, I was out there full time. So
nice.
That was just a nice little, you know, fun little thing to do, and then you're done, and it's time to get back to the serious work.
Well, it's funny because the first bridge was constructed in 28. It was signed off on in January of 29, a cold, terrible day, and open to traffic. And then they had the celebration that summer. And so I was thinking, wait a minute, the new bridge would have had this exact same deal. That at one point, somebody would have looked at somebody else and said, well, get in and drive across it.
Oh, of course, yeah. And I'm trying to remember when we opened it to traffic. We opened it to traffic a little bit before the opening celebration. It was held in September because we had to actually get traffic onto it to finish some of the work that we were required to do to prepare the old bridge to be a pedestrian bridge.
Oh, right. Okay.
So yeah, we had to put traffic on the new bridge. And I know we did it that summer. I cannot remember the date right now. Sure, there's some documentation somewhere on that. And then once traffic was used in the new bridge, then we were able to wrap up those items that we had to do to open the pedestrian bridge up.
That makes sense, because I remember seeing pictures of the dedication, and the whole bridge is a walking bridge with big bollards in the ground. You can't drive over the thing anymore. You can walk it, and that's what it is. And so that meant that the new bridge was up and running.
Exactly, yeah. Because it took a bit of time. I'd say probably took at least 2 months worth of time to do that.
Okay. Great. What else do you recall about that which was interesting, unusual, or that you remember?
Oh, I think for a few of the people that were out there and that I stayed in touch with, with almost all of them by now, but I think we were all very taken with the area. We, especially, you know, some of the local personalities that were there down there, the ones that was a very interesting community that lived down there at Vermilion Cliffs that we hung out with a lot. Just the style of living back then, the remoteness of it. Absolutely. There were times, and this is very, very, very beginning days of the internet. There was certainly no internet out there. And the phone system was still a dial phone system. It wasn't a digital phone system.
Okay.
And it was prone to going down. And so there would be times where for 1 or 2 weeks you couldn't make or receive a phone call.
Oh, wow.
And so just living in a very remote place was very, very interesting.
What would you do if you had to make a call? Would you, like, drive over to the Gap, or what would you do?
Typically, if you needed to make a phone call, you could go up to Page.
Okay. Yeah.
We had it set up that if people knew that we had some base unit radios in the area that were in our trucks and in my office, that guys that were 5-10 miles away could talk to me, and if necessary, I could drive up to the National Park Service office and they could use their radio to contact me out if there had been any emergency. Thank goodness there never was. You had to think about those kind of things. And there was a reason at one time that was considered the most remote place in the lower 48 states.
Right. No, I was just thinking, if you needed to order some steel or some little odd part and the phone didn't work, you were going to be traveling a ways to make that happen.
Yeah. And some of it, especially when I lived there in Flagstaff, on Friday afternoons or evenings, and I had some of those calls from down there too. But it didn't have. It happened. It did not happen every
month. Right.
It certainly did happen.
Okay. All right. Cool.
And there were places. This is back in the days of fax machines, and I had to fax things into the main office. And for whatever reason, we found out quickly that I could not fax to our main office in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
The systems just weren't compatible. So anything I needed to send to our main office in Wisconsin, I had to send to our regional office in Phoenix, and they would refax it.
Wow.
To Wisconsin.
Huh, how about that? That's odd. Okay. Looking back on that now, what do you think about it?
Well, it still is probably my favorite project I've built. It was my first time as a project manager, so there was a lot of learning process for me. There was the uniqueness of the situation. There was a good team of people, by and large, real good team of people. Environment. It felt like you were in the southwest version of the old television show Northern Exposure. It's what it felt like, quite honestly. I remember back then I used to get the Key West Citizen newspaper. I had a mail order subscription to it. I used to spend some time there. And I would get it, and then, of course, it would be 2 weeks old by the time I got it. I would leave it at one of the bars there, the bar and grills. And I'd walk in, and the next time I'd walk in, you'd have 4 or 5 people sitting there reading articles and having a discussion about life in Key West.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Very, very interesting.
Well, I talked with Barry Adams recently, and he recalled you and your wife, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And that she was making pies, apple pies. And he really enjoyed those.
Yeah. Had some good guys there.
Yeah. Back in the day.
Some good folks. Learned how to make beer while I lived there. You had to learn all kinds of new hobbies. So.
Nice. Is there anything else you would like to bring into this oral history that I haven't asked you about or that you're thinking about?
Again, say it's a wonderful time, wonderful job, and a wonderful place. And I haven't been able to get out there since 2000, 2005 or no, no, no. I'm sorry. I was there in 2012. Was the last time I was there.
Okay.
But I would like to go again.
Next time you come out, let's go out there with a tape recorder. And we'll do a little recording on site and see what your memory has come back when you're standing there looking at it. That would be great.
Now, one of the neat things when I was there is there were condors on the new bridge.
Yes.
Sitting there on the ribs. I was like, oh, my. They had been talking about releasing them when we were there, but they hadn't started yet. But now to see condors perched there on the steel is really thrilling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very, very fun. Well, with that, I'm going to wrap this up, but hold the line for a minute, Jeff. This will conclude part three of our Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Jeff St. John. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Jeff, thank you so very much.